It's to the best of our knowledge. I'm Ann Strainchamps. What makes a great school? The quality of teaching? Class size? The budget? When it comes to school reform, everyone has an opinion. In this hour, we'll talk about ways to improve education in America, whether by empowering students.
People of all ages tend to excel when they enjoy what they're doing, and they tend to enjoy what they're doing more when they have some voice.
Or by taking the classroom into the home.
The idea is that you tap into a child's intrinsic desire to learn by setting them free to explore.
Today, rethinking schools and the way we teach. Behind the debates over school reform lies a deeper question. What exactly do kids need to be successful adults? Schools can teach them math and science and how to write a grammatical sentence. But the traits that lead to success later in life also include things like self-discipline and emotional intelligence. And those can't be found in textbooks or measured by Scantron tests. Or can they? Robert Sternberg is a professor of human development at Cornell University. A psychologist by training, he also developed new tests and standards for admitting students at Tufts and at Oklahoma State University. He believes we need to change the way we evaluate students, starting with college entrance exams.
I got interested in studying intelligence actually as a young kid. When I was in elementary school, they used to, at least in New Jersey, give group IQ tests every year, and I bombed them. And as a result, my teachers thought I was stupid. I thought I was stupid. And what I realized even then as a young kid is that the test created a sort of self-fulfilling prophecy. So in second grade, I didn't do very well. In third grade, I did worse. And then in fourth grade, I had a teacher, Mrs. Alexa, who thought there's more to a kid than just IQ test score. And she expected a lot of me, and I really wanted to make her happy. So I became an A student, and I realized that I was not predestined by the test to be kind of a flop. And that got me interested in the whole idea of IQ testing, and I continue with that interest, really, from elementary school until now.
So is it also true for college entrance exams, what you came to think about traditional tests of intelligence, that they're not that predictive?
I hate to tell you this, but college entrance exams are disguised IQ tests. A professor at Case Western, Doug Detterman, has done studies on the SAT and the ACT, and they correlate as highly with IQ tests as different IQ tests correlate with each other. So you can call them different things for marketing purposes, but they're all pretty much the same. They measure sort of analytical cognitive abilities and memory.
Now, is that still true? Because the College Board has made a lot of changes to the tests over the years.
Yes, the College Board has made some changes, ACT perhaps fewer changes. But what's interesting is a British psychologist named Charles Spearman found back in 1904 that it pretty much didn't matter what cosmetic changes you made. So-called cognitive ability tests all measure the same thing. And one of the reasons that the SAT is now being changed again is that the last change resulted in a more expensive, longer test, but it didn't really tell you much beyond what the shorter, less expensive test told you.
So what is it that they don't measure that would be important?
They don't measure most of the things that matter for success, certainly in life, and a lot of the things that matter for success in college. Creative skills, your skill in coming up with new innovative and impactful ideas. They don't measure practical skills or common sense. And anybody in any job knows how important common sense is. They don't measure wisdom or you're trying to do things that help some kind of common good. They don't measure ethics. They don't measure emotional intelligence. They don't measure your sense of responsibility. They don't measure your integrity. So there are just lots of things that they don't measure.
Well, maybe those things are not measurable. I mean, how do you measure somebody's wisdom or emotional intelligence or ethics? Or, I mean, these are, you know, deep character traits.
Yeah. Well, I used to be a professor at Yale, And back in those days, we were funded to create a test. And the idea was, let's say we measured creative skills as well as practical skills in addition to the analytical skills that the SAT or the ACT measures. So we created some creative items, some practical items, where you might see a little movie with a student in it and you say how the student should respond to a practical situation, like dividing rental payments for a flat where the rooms are different sizes. And what we found is that by including just creative and practical measures, we could double prediction of first-year grades, and we could reduce ethnic group differences.
Now, I'm fascinated that along with the other criteria you said you wanted to look at, like common sense or pragmatism and creative abilities, you also include wisdom as a trait to test for. You know, I think of wisdom as a quality that people develop later in life. You know, it's the intelligence that develops as a result of a lot of life experience. How would you estimate that or evaluate it in high school students?
Well, first of all, I certainly hope you're right, because that would bode well for me as I get older. But that aside, an example of an item would be, tell us about some passion you have in high school that later in your life you could turn toward a common good and how you might do that at some future time. What we look at is not actually the answer, but at the kind of reasoning you use. So there is no right answer, but rather we rate for the extent to which you combine sort of creative, analytical, and practical thinking to seek a common good. And so we're looking at not the answer per se, but how you think about the problem. Wisdom isn't really in an answer. It's not something you can measure with multiple choice. It's how you think about a problem.
Hmm. Why are you interested in adding wisdom to those criteria? I mean, do you think colleges have been graduating students who are somehow deficient in wisdom?
Well, I think that we have no lack of smart people in this society. In fact, what James Flynn has found is that in the 20th century, IQs rose 3 points every 10 years. So people are actually, in an IQ sense, getting smarter. But here's the question. Are there lots of leaders that you can look at, whether it's in politics or business or science or athletics, who strike you as really wise? These are smart people. They have high IQs. A lot of them actually went to very prestigious schools. Mm-hmm. And so what I began to realize is that there's a big difference between sort of IQ, SAT, ACT smarts, and on the one hand, common sense, which is just your sort of practical skills in living, and wisdom, which is taking those practical skills and doing things that are good not just for you, but for others, your state, your country, the world. And we don't have that many people these days who seem to have that broader perspective. And I think if you look at failed leaders or leaders who are really not making the grade, it's almost never because their IQs are too low or they didn't go to Harvard. It's because they're unwise or unethical.
You know, the underlying question behind a lot of what we're talking about is, what is intelligence? That is, what kind of intelligence leads to success later in life, and not just, you know, business or professional success, but what kind of intelligence makes a successful human being?
Yeah, when I talk about intelligence, I sometimes use the term successful intelligence. And what I mean by that is your skill in setting meaningful and reasonable goals for your life, and then your skill in doing what you can to achieve those goals. And when you add wisdom, it's that the goals are not only for your own benefit or the benefit of your family and friends, but for the larger benefit. So what universities need to do, what colleges and universities need to do, is they need to educate active, concerned citizens and ethical leaders who are going to make a positive, meaningful, and enduring difference to the world. And that's a different focus from just educating people with high test scores.
Hmm. Bob, do you worry at all about, I don't know, the possible unintended consequences of bringing online new ways of evaluating students. And I'm just thinking the whole business of applying to college is so intense for a lot of students, and not just the top performers. Students are now competing with each other at very pressured levels. I just imagine a world in which now they're all saying, okay, now I've got to demonstrate creativity and pragmatism and wisdom. I'm thinking applying to college is already exhausting.
What we found in the places where we have implemented them is that the students actually like it because they feel that tests like the SAT and the ACT and grades don't give a very complete picture of who they are. As a society, what we require in college admissions sort of sends a message to high schools, middle schools, even elementary schools, about what we value in people. And we've become a test-centric society where the message we send is it's about your ability to answer multiple-choice questions that really assess, I won't say trivial problem-solving, but certainly non-impactful problem-solving.
Yeah.
And that isn't the message we should be sending to kids because, look, when you get into a job, there's no one who says, here's the problem, what should you do, A, B, C, or D? It just doesn't happen. Often the hardest part is figuring out what the problem is. So when you just give a kid a problem and say, is it A, B, C, or D, you're missing the point. When you have problems with your spouse or problems with your kids or problems on your job, first you have to even recognize something's wrong. Then you have to figure out what the problem is. Then you have to figure out how you're going to solve it. But there's no one who just says, here's the problem and here are the four choices. It's not the way life is.
Robert Sternberg is a professor of human development at Cornell University. He's the author of the book College Admissions for the 21st Century. So here's a radical idea. How about we stop measuring and comparing kids on the basis of their academic achievements? Alfie Cohn believes if we want kids to love learning, we should forget about grades. Cohn is one of America's most passionate advocates for progressive education, and he's written a bunch of books on the subject, including Feel Bad Education.
Grades are a way not only of reflecting what the teacher thinks the kid has done, but of trying to control the classroom by saying, if you don't study this, if you don't come here on time, if you don't memorize more facts on command, your grade will drop. So it's a way of doing things to students to make them comply, rather than working with students to help them learn. Students who are trying to get a good grade tend to become less interested in whatever it is they're doing. Students are less excited about reading, about math, if they're trying to do it for a grade. Students trying to get a good grade will pick the easiest possible task if they're given a choice when they're doing it for a grade. Not because they're lazy, but because they're rational. Duh, they figure. The simpler the thing I'm doing, the better the chance I can give you what you seem to want, which is not intellectual risk-taking. It's the opposite of risk-taking. It's just to get an A. Kids who are trying to get a good grade tend to forget what they learned faster and think in a more superficial fashion. So the more interested we are in kids who love learning, prefer challenge, and want to think deeply, the less we have to be grading them and the more we have to be thinking about other ways to assess the classroom. And so the alternative to grades are either to offer a narrative report, a written summary to explain what's going on with the kid, or better yet, a conversation with the student and the student's parents in order to talk about what's been going on and what our hopes are in the future. You don't have to make kids love learning. You have to start by being committed to not killing the curiosity about the world that all students start out with. At least 10 studies have found that children's intrinsic motivation, their curiosity, their disposition to figure stuff out, make sense of the world, starts out very high when they're young, and then, subject to worksheets, homework, quizzes, lectures, grades, standardized tests, behavior management programs, that desire to figure stuff out about the world begins quite reliably to tail off. What we have to do, and what great teachers that I see all over the country and beyond doing, is starting with projects and problems and questions as the organizing principles of teaching, rather than facts and skills and separate disciplines. The other characteristics that tend to describe amazing classrooms where kids are disappointed when the final bell rings are, first, that it feels like a caring community of learners where we're in this together. We're never set against each other in a contest, and we're only rarely isolated from each other on separate desks. And second, the kids play an active role as well as an interactive role in helping to design what it is they're learning, because people of all ages tend to excel when they enjoy what they're doing, and they tend to enjoy what they're doing more when they have some voice.
Alfie Cohn is an advocate for progressive education and author of the book Feel Bad Education and No Contest, The Case Against Competition. Coming up, debating the merits of homeschooling. I'm Ann Strainchamps. It's To the Best of Our Knowledge from Wisconsin Public Radio and PRI, Public Radio International. It's To the Best of Our Knowledge, and this hour we're rethinking schools. Homeschooling is an increasingly popular option for many families. In fact, the number of kids being homeschooled has ballooned in the past decade. But does homeschooling measure up to traditional public schools? Filmmaker Astra Taylor was homeschooled herself. Today, she embraces an even more radical version called unschooling. Journalist Dana Goldstein, on the other hand, believes homeschooling can undercut traditional support for public education. The two debated the issue in articles published in Slate and N+1 magazine, and Steve Paulson got them together in a studio.
Astra, let me start with you. To put this in context, I think we need to talk about your own experience of unschooling, which is a much more radical version of homeschooling. First of all, can you explain the philosophy behind unschooling?
Most people have an idea of what homeschooling is. It's having school at home. Unschooling is sort of the radical cousin to that. And the idea essentially is that we are learning animals. Children, what they do is learn. You don't need to teach a baby how to speak. You speak to it, and then, you know, it masters the art of speaking. So the idea is that you tap into a child's intrinsic desire to learn by sort of setting them free to explore. And it's a very romantic view of human nature, of education and pedagogy. And so when I think back to my childhood, I often envision it as a kind of nutrient-rich broth that my siblings and I were sort of allowed to absorb and move in. And, you know, there were no tests. There was no class time. Our parents were not our teachers. It was this very informal, child-centered experience. And we are not alone. This is a tradition that goes back decades, but really got started with John Holt in the 70s.
Now, this was not just sort of taking the curriculum that a lot of homeschoolers use and doing it at home. You had no set structure for a typical day?
No. There's no curriculum, no tests. You know, we would wake up in the morning and well, what did we feel like doing that day? Maybe we felt like drawing or reading or playing or, you know, roaming around in the woods behind the house. You know, my parents had this sort of boundless faith that we were interesting people and we would find something interesting to do, and that, You know, my mother would say, when you're bored, you're boring. And so the idea was, you know, you should care about the world. You should care about learning. And, you know, you, the children, should pursue it. I shouldn't have to be sitting here with carrots and sticks driving you.
Mm-hmm. Now, in your essay in N Plus One, you go on to say unschooling worked for your family. I mean, you're all mm-hmm. literate. You know enough math to be able to balance a checkbook. You have all pursued various creative projects, you and your siblings, and you, of course, are a filmmaker. It all sounds pretty good. So, Dana, let me bring you into this conversation. Why did Astra's essay get under your skin?
I was sort of troubled by the notion of unschooling and homeschooling as well as a model or something we should look to in terms of how to think about improving public schools. And the reason why is because so few parents have the privilege, have the option of implementing this sort of education for their children. So we know that a third of all kids and half of poor children are being raised by a single parent. And it's just very rare for a single parent to have the option to have the massive outlay of labor that it takes to educate one's child at home. And then the other point that I brought up in my Slate article that I think is really important is that in our society, the social institutions, the public institutions that have the most buy-in are the ones that tend to attract political support and improve over time. So, for example, when you think about Medicare, it's very protected politically because almost all senior citizens do use it. And with public schools, we need to be broadly improving public schools, and there's a growing body of research on peer effects. And basically, the best way to summarize that is to say that children learn more when they're in a classroom with children who have invested parents in their education. So, for example, a poor child learns more when they're in a classroom that is not just 100% made up of poor children, but also has middle-class kids in it, while the middle-class child, their test scores, there's not a lot of evidence that their learning is impeded by the presence of less privileged kids. So I'm sort of making this argument in the Slate piece that we should really think twice about pulling children out of the public system, that if we want to invest in our public schools, if we want to improve them over time, there's a big argument to be made that everyone has a better outcome when more people invest and participate in public schools.
So it sounds like you're not really questioning whether homeschooling is as good as it's cracked up to be. Your focus is on the larger social good, whether homeschooling undermines support for the public schools. And you're saying that we need to do everything in our power to make public schools better.
Yeah, there's two ways I'd respond to that. First, it's clear that for individuals like Astra and her siblings, there can be many positive outcomes of homeschooling. And I've certainly met people who've been homeschooled, have had wonderful experiences, and are wonderful, well-rounded, socially adept adults. I'm not making the argument that some critics of homeschooling make that it's bad for the child. I think for many children, it could be a very positive experience. I'm sort of asking parents who might be considering homeschooling and who do care, who do want to improve public schools, to think twice, because I think that having those sorts of parents and families participating in and invested in the public school system really does broadly improve public schools. And I think there's a lot of interesting research showing that students who attend public schools, who attend socioeconomically and racially diverse public schools, do carry a certain set of values with them into adulthood that are very positive. Now, I think it's clear from the debate that Astra and I have been having over the past couple of weeks that she and I share those values. So certainly you can bring those values into adulthood as someone who's been unschooled or someone who's been homeschooled.
Okay, Astra, let me bring you back into the conversation here. Is homeschooling undermining support for public schools?
I don't think it is. One thing I said in my reply to Dana was that the number of radical unschoolers or even secular homeschoolers pales in comparison to the number of parents who use the public school system but do everything in their power to move to the best school districts and get their kids to the best schools. Just the other day, the mother in Connecticut who put her child into a better school using, I think, a family member's address, was just charged with stealing education. She's being asked to pay $15,000 for stealing education, and she's going to jail for it. You know, that's someone who tried to move her kid into a better school district, and that's the punishment.
Isn't it true that virtually every family, if they have any choice at all, is going to try to construct the best educational environment for their kids? I mean, whether it's out of school or in school, and if it's in school, aren't they going to try to do whatever they can to help their kids get ahead, their own kids?
Yeah, I think that they will. And I think Dana and I agree that what we need to do is think beyond the family in what's good for the individual family. And so, you know, one thing I think that unschooling, you know, the point of my unschooling piece actually was not just to praise, you know, staying home all day and doing whatever you want. In fact, the entire essay, and it's a long essay, is grappling with my ambivalence towards the implications of this tradition that I was raised in. It's a tradition that I love and feel has so much to offer in terms of its philosophy of learning and trust in children. But, you know, is it scalable? Is the world I want to live in one in which everybody stays home and is educated by their parents? You know, the answer is no. So, you know, what I wrestle with is what are the broader social implications? And I end up visiting this alternative free school in Albany that actually caters to inner city kids who have not been able to flourish in the public school system or kind of, you know, it's a last resort for them to go to this democratic school.
So this is Albany, Albany, New York.
Albany Free School. And so these are issues I'm grappling with. So, you know, I think that actually all parents, whether they want to educate their kids at home or they use the school system, need to think about the larger social good. And so what I think unschooling does, the thought experiment of unschooling is not, what if everybody stayed home all day? That's not it. The thought experiment of unschooling is, what if we let go of the testing, the fostering of a sort of competitive ethos that focuses on grades, on being at the top of the class? What if we totally abandoned all of these aspects of instruction that we're so attached to, that we think we kind of need to coerce children into learning?
Dana, let me turn to you about that thought experiment. Do you basically agree with what Astra is saying?
I agree with Astra that I'd like to see public schools be more intellectually engaging and less obsessed with test scores and more student-driven and progressive in their pedagogical techniques. Where I disagree is that you need to look at a private school like the Albany Free School, or you need to look at a really radical social experiment like homeschooling or unschooling to find examples of that. I think in our political debate about education, public schools are often just painted as totally failing institutions. And as an education reporter who's been covering this sector for 6 years, I can say undoubtedly that there are just so many wonderful progressive public schools that embrace these same values that Astra's talking about. If you look at the Community Roots School in Brooklyn, New York, which is near to where I live, if you look at the Urban Assembly schools here in New York City, those are schools that are working within the confines of the public system, and they're embracing so many of these progressive curricular and pedagogical values. And so I'm very invested in the idea that when we think about how to improve public schools, we look at successful public schools. Because in our education reform debate, too often we say only charter schools, only strict discipline, no excuses charter schools, those are the only ones that are successful. Or the only way that we can successfully, you know, improve education is to totally get rid of all mandates about what students do and what students learn, which is just not, that's not realistic in our political debate. We're in an environment in which standards and accountability are driving the education reform conversation. But I think what's hopeful is that there are public schools that are existing within that climate and embracing progressive values. And those are the schools that I look at in a lot of my reporting.
Astra Taylor is a documentary filmmaker, and Dana Goldstein is a journalist. Steve Paulson spoke with them. Not everyone needs to go to school to succeed. There are plenty of examples of self-taught men and women who went on to achieve greatness. Daniel Wolfe wrote about a few of them in his book, How Lincoln Learned to Read. He described a few of these cases and how they shape the way we think of public education, starting with Benjamin Franklin.
He's a real prototype, I think, in how Americans look at their education. And he was a dropout and spent a good deal of his career then making fun of educated people. So I think that sense of what is this good for and why do we do it goes way back, pre the United States, and is a very healthy thing.
Tell us a little bit more about Ben Franklin, because from your description of what he was like as a boy and young teenager, he sounds like a kid who today would probably be diagnosed with ADHD.
You know, he was the 10th child of his parents, who were soap and candle makers in Boston. And there was a Puritan tradition that your 10th child was your tithe and would become a member of the church. And he read very early on, which was, I think, partly because he was smart and also because he had all these older siblings who were wandering around reading. So they sent him to Boston Latin. And the route was that you were supposed to go to Boston Latin, and that would get you into Harvard, which was one of the first colleges, and that would turn you into a minister. So he was all set on that route, and he did a year of it and dropped out for slightly mysterious reasons, although he does mention in his autobiography that he was a leader of boys and often led them into trouble. Hmm. So that may have been part of it. He then tried a year of something called a writing school, which was much reduced from Boston Latin. It was essentially reading, writing, arithmetic, and then never went to school again. He worked at his father's soap and candle business, which was in the downstairs of their house. And then he was apprenticed to his older brother, who was a printer.
And some of his early writings, when he began writing for his brother's papers under a pseudonym, he delighted in kind of skewering what people at the time thought was important in education, right?
Absolutely. I mean, one of the first things he wrote under a pseudonym of Silence Do Good as a widow woman in the country. And this was a fairly strong tradition at that point, was that you took a pseudonym and kind of disguised yourself that way so you could say all sorts of outrageous things. And one of the first columns he wrote, which his brother didn't even know he'd written, because he was sure his brother wouldn't publish him if he did know, was about a dream she had that everybody who went to Harvard went there just to make money and make connections and didn't really care about the Bible or becoming ministers and cribbed their sermons. And it's the sort of thing that in a Puritan colony you couldn't get away with for a second if you signed your own name to it. And he managed to do it, again, under a pseudonym and would do it, you know, as Poor Richard later on in his life and did it all through his life. It was sort of a tweaking of the establishment.
So this scorn for elitist education goes way back to the founding of this country, and you can see it running all the way through, you know, right up to the present day. And yet, oddly, Franklin himself, for all his scorn of elitist education, went on to become a big proponent of schools and of education, right?
Right. I mean, you know, proposed a college where, granted, they wouldn't have to study Latin and Greek, but they would still learn. Yeah, I think it's a conflict that continues to exist, which is, on the one hand, there are things that you can be taught and learn in an academic environment that are useful. And on the other hand, people going, yeah, but what really counts is what you go out and do. One of the other guys I profile is Henry Ford. And Ford went through, I think, eighth grade out in Michigan. And he would later say, you know, to be a king of industry, as he turned out, you needed a little school, but not too much.
Yeah, well, Ford's another famous scorner of formal education. Isn't he the guy who said history is bunk?
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. I don't want to give the impression that all of these people felt that way. I mean, you look at, for example, Abigail Adams, who's the person I profile after Franklin. She desperately wanted more school, and she couldn't because she was a girl.
Yeah, so that's the other strand that runs through this history is all of the disenfranchised populations, women and Black Americans and Native Americans, and their struggle to be allowed into education. So what was Abigail Adams' life like as a young girl and as a young woman? What were girls allowed to learn then?
Well, her father did what Ben Franklin turned down, which is went the Boston Latin Harvard minister route and ended up a minister in a small town. And he and his in-laws both had pretty good libraries. So although she couldn't go to school, she was a person with some money and some leisure and spent hours in the library reading and eventually writing. She was, you know, I think one of our great letter writers back and forth because she was separated from John Adams so long. You know, one of the things I talk about is that in the era of the letter, you kind of needed to write because that was how you maintained your contacts with your friends and family. So that was a real skill that she taught herself, but that was very useful to her for, you know, the rest of her life.
At what point did the vision of American public education begin to include higher education?
Well, you know, later on, post-Civil War, I profiled W.E.B. Du Bois. And here's a African-American in Massachusetts, and his kind of way out, his hope, was schooling. Because it was the one arena he felt where he was going to be judged on what he did, not on the color of his skin or his economic background. for Du Bois, it was absolutely the key to the kingdom. It meant, as far as he could tell, that he could get a better job. And more importantly, he realized that he could go to college, which was, you know, out of the question for a black man in those days. There, I think what I found was something like 650 Negroes had graduated from college in the entire history of the country when he decided to go.
So to a certain extent, he wanted to prove that a black man could go to college. And I suppose, did he think that once he went to college, he would, in a sense, be free?
You know, he's very kind of stark about that. He says he wanted to go to college because all the other kids did.
You know, so far, all the stories of great Americans that you've looked at, the one thing they all have in common is whether or not they managed to get much of an education, they were all really fueled by this profound hunger for education. They were drawn with a great intensity, all of them, to book learning and to books and to the world of ideas. I guess it makes me wonder what it is that propels some people into greatness and whether you – I don't think you can teach that. I think it's just inborn. But what do you think?
Well, that was Henry Ford's theory, and it ended up looking pretty ugly by the time he was done, because Henry Ford essentially said you're either born great or not. And what public education was for was to teach everybody else to stay in line, essentially. And in line is the right metaphor, because, you know, he was setting up a conveyor belt. And he wanted people to be well-behaved and have enough education to do the job, and that was it. And at the end of the day, that doesn't look good, to me anyway, because one of the things I learned from the book is I think, from writing it, is I think everybody has that hunger. I mean, I haven't met anybody who doesn't want to learn. Henry Ford wanted to learn about gears and watches. That's what he cared most about. He was terrible in school, ended up not being able to spell. You know, Rachel Carson, someone else I wrote about, wanted to go out into the woods and wanted to see the ocean because she grew up in Pennsylvania and never had. I think that hunger is there. I think it, in fact, takes quite a lot of effort to stamp it out of people.
Daniel Wolfe is the author of the book, How Lincoln Learned to Read, 12 Great Americans and the Educations That Made Them.
And that's it for our discussion about rethinking schools. When we come back, writer Sarah Lewis shares a bookmark, and journalist Jose Antonio Vargas talks about life as an undocumented immigrant. I'm Ann Strainchamps. It's To the Best of Our Knowledge from Wisconsin Public Radio and PRI, Public Radio International. And now, bookmarks, writers on books they love.
Hi, I'm Sarah Lewis, author of The Rise, Creativity, The Gift of Failure, and The Search for Mastery. The book I'd like to recommend is a classic that is underappreciated, The Power of Myth by Joseph Campbell. This is a book that reminds us that stories are the guiding force for how we live our lives. Joseph Campbell spent so many years teaching at Sarah Lawrence, looking at the various different mythologies around the world, finding their common themes, and reminding us of what we have lost by not continuing to pass them on to subsequent generations. He inspired tons of artists with this idea, but I feel that so many people have forgotten the message. They remember the pithy quote, "Follow your bliss."
but they forget how to do that oftentimes. I think without mythology, without stories, we rob ourselves of the guideposts that we kind of need to make our lives and to create it the way that we want to. I read this book when I was really young. I've moved maybe 10 times since college. There are very few books I keep with me in every location, and this is one of them. For me, it's a kind of a Talmudic text. I go to different parts of it at different times in my life just to find sustenance. You know, what it has done for me is made me think about ritual more, what rituals I need to mark moments. Many of the myths, for example, in the book are about rites of passage. How to go from girl to woman, how to go from, in my case, a teacher, say, to a writer, how to see yourself differently. And so I find myself creating rituals for myself, creating rituals for my family that I feel just heighten the sense of presence I have about where I am in my life. So there's some that are communal. So much of creative work, for an author in particular, can be solitary. And coming together to bring out through just conversation are for me now ways that I mark moments. Sometimes I'll bring people together and ask them to think about a certain question and to come with a story of what's happened in their life that deals with it. And there's so much strength that I derive from those conversations that I often will kind of begin a big endeavor by doing that and end it by doing that. Rituals, sometimes we associate with spiritual practice, right? As more people move away from having a religion in their life but become increasingly spiritual, I'm finding that these self-created rituals are really important.
Sarah Lewis recommends The Power of Myth by Joseph Campbell with Bill Moyers. You can find more bookmarks on our website at ttbook.org. And now, On Our Minds. This week we're thinking about immigration reform in America. As Capitol Hill continues the debate, we revisit an interview with the Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist-turned-activist José Antonio Vargas. Back in 2011, Vargas outed himself as an undocumented immigrant in a New York Times Magazine cover story. Now he is the director and subject of the film Documented. It chronicles his experience as an undocumented immigrant. He spoke with Steve Paulson.
So you did the thing that would be the last thing in the world anyone would suggest. You wrote a huge story for the New York Times Magazine coming out saying you are undocumented. You're not legally here.
You know, for me, it was like, how do I do this in such a big way that I couldn't just be speaking for me, that I could be speaking for other people who are experiencing the exact same thing? Undocumented people are completely integrated in American life. We're visibly invisible.
But on the other hand, I mean, you had to be thinking, as soon as you made this public, and so everyone could see this, that you were going to get booted out of the country.
Well, I mean, look, I'm a journalist, right? I'm trained to think about various scenarios. So I prepared myself for all the scenarios, including deportation. Like, what do I do? Do I, like, pack all my stuff and just in case I did get deported? Like, I have a lot of stuff here. Like, what do I do, you know? What I wasn't prepared for, frankly, was like nothing happened. I was expecting to hear from the Department of Homeland Security. Nothing. And that's why, you know, a few months into this, I contacted the editor of Time Magazine, Rick Stengel, and I said, I want to write a story about why I haven't gotten deported.
And we should point out, I mean, this is still very real. I mean, you could get deported.
Oh, this is – I mean, somebody could go to the studio right now and decide to deport me and arrest me. You know, like they can do that. And – I got to tell you, when I was younger, Martin Luther King's book, Letter from Birmingham Jail, provided an enormous amount of peace to me. Because, you know, like we live in a country of laws. And for Martin Luther King to quote St. Augustine and say an unjust law is no law at all, that was in my head, you know, the 5 years that I was a reporter for The Washington Post living and walking around Washington, D.C. and going to the White House and going to press conferences, Capitol Hill. And like, you know, I was like a walking time bomb. I was just sure that I was going to explode. I mean, I remember the morning after the Christmas during the Iowa caucuses in 2007, and The Washington Post sent me to Iowa to cover the caucuses. And there I am walking around with Mike Huckabee going pheasant hunting. And Huckabee starts talking about these illegal alien people, and I wanted to raise my hand and say, Governor, I'm one of these illegal aliens you're talking about, and I'm not from Mars. And I felt so cowardly never doing it.
So even though you have been living here since what? Since you were 12 years old, I mean, living in the United States, you basically have no way to become a legal citizen?
So there's a couple of ways. One way is for me to just leave, go to the Philippines, where I haven't been since I was 12, and accept the 10-year bar before I could apply to get back. The other way is to marry. I'm gay, so I can't pretend to be too late now. I could do that. I could marry a guy. I live in New York, and New York State recognizes same-sex marriage. But unfortunately, the federal government, because of the Defense of Marriage Act, does not. So I'm still stuck in the same limbo. One lawyer suggested, why don't you get married in New York, find somebody to marry, then sue the federal government.
It's a little more than you want to take on.
Or actually, one of my friends said, why don't you get together with a transgender person and really shake this up? You know, and I'm like, oh, no. I think I'm like a walking, uncomfortable conversation as it is. Like, I don't think I can handle, you know.
But, yeah. I mean, that's partly what you're saying is that this is a conversation no one wants to have. And I guess that's what's prevented you from getting deported. I mean, no one wants to take this on because the issues are not only so difficult to talk about, but there's absurdity here.
It's absurdity, but also I think it's a complicated conversation because we live in a country that doesn't honor our own history. Like, I feel like I'm literally just like, okay, remember that time between 1892 and 1956 when 12 million undocumented white people from Europe crossed the border known as the Atlantic Ocean and then landed on Ellis Island with no papers? They just showed up. They were welcomed. And one out of three Americans can trace their ancestors to Ellis Island. And here we are nearly 60 years later dealing with 11 million people. So what's the difference? And people are saying, oh, it's overpopulation or, you know, lazy brown people who would tax our resources. I should just say, as an undocumented person who's been living in this country since I was 12, I've been paying taxes since I was 18 years old, since I started working. I have paid so much state and federal taxes, I might as well be a Republican. Because guess what? The IRS doesn't care whether or not I have papers. All they care about is that they get their money every year. Why don't we ever bring that up?
Well, we should talk a bit about your personal story. I mean, how you originally came here. Because you were brought over by your grandparents who were legal immigrants, correct?
Yeah. So I'm like, what, 17 million other households in America. I'm in a mixed status family. My mother decided to give me a better life. And so she sent me to live with my grandparents who had legally immigrated to the United States in the mid 80s. And, you know, I was 12, so I didn't really know about any of this stuff. All I knew was I was in America. 4 years later, when I applied for my driver's license, a driver's permit when I was 16, I didn't tell my grandparents I was going to go to the DMV. I just went by myself. And when I showed the woman at the booth my green card as a proof of identification, she kind of flipped it around twice and looked at me and she said, this is fake. Don't come back here again.
Wow.
That's how I found out.
You didn't know that you were not a legal resident.
It was kind of not talked about. It was just I was just here. And so after the woman at the DMV told me that, I, you know, rode my bike back home and my grandfather was there. I confronted him and he said, what are you doing showing that to people, the green card that is, and you're not supposed to be here.
So, I mean, your story raises all kinds of questions. I mean, how do you do things like get a driver's license or go to college? I mean, how did you get into college? How do you apply for jobs if you don't have any legal status?
So that's the thing. I mean, I wanted to have a job. And my first job was Subway sandwiches. My grandfather bought me a fake passport and a fake Social Security number. But in the Social Security number and in the card itself, it says not eligible for work. So we went – he drove me to the Kinko's, not too far from where we live. And he basically cut up a small piece of white tape and put it over the line that says not eligible for work. And then we made 25 copies of it. I was 17, I think, at the time. That was what I had to show Subway. It was just a photocopied version. And to my surprise, that was fine. Now, that's the same photocopied Social Security that I showed the Washington Post, the San Francisco Chronicle, the New Yorker, the Huffington Post.
But what about getting into college?
Getting into college. So this was pre-DREAM Act. So I found that I was undocumented when I was a freshman in high school. So after that, I was like, what's the point, right? I mean, why even go to college? So I never took the SATs. I just wasn't – college wasn't really an option for me. That was my thinking. And then when I was a senior, the principal, who I got to know pretty well, Pat Hyland, was wondering why I wasn't applying to colleges. And mind you, at that point, I was already out as gay. I came out when I was a junior. So I was known – I was the only openly gay kid in school. So I was known as the gay kid in school. So – after that, I told the principal that there was this other thing. And Pat Hyland told the high school superintendent, Rich Fisher. And at that point, they were like, do we adopt you? Like, what do we do? And they talked to lawyers, and the lawyers said there's nothing you can do. And so they found this venture capitalist who started a scholarship fund. And that's how I got to college.
Well, and partly what you're saying is it's not just – farm workers or nannies who were working under the table. I mean, you're talking, you know, not only journalists, probably doctors, lawyers, teachers.
Yeah. To be an undocumented person in America, this is not a black or white issue. It's all gray area. My grandfather lied for me, but I was an adult and his lies became my lies. And I had to justify being at the Washington Post for 5 years, right? I remember when I got the internship offer from the Washington Post, my first phone call was for my principal, who's become like a mother figure in my life. I called her up and I said, Pat, am I taking somebody else's job? The first thing she said was she laughed. And the second thing is she goes, don't think that way. You know, like you earned this.
So you're saying there's this whole – it's not just about –
underground.
It's not just about whether you're going to get deported or not. It's about, you know, whether you belong here.
Whether you belong and how I justified it to myself morally. The justification was I'm contributing. I'm paying taxes. I'm writing stories that no one else is writing. I'm going to be as good as I possibly can be. I'm going to justify my taking space.
What does it mean for you to be an American? What does it mean to be an American?
To me, to be an American is to feel free. I think there's the possibility of America, the fact that our history is always unfolding before us, the fact that we're always evolving, the fact that we are always trying to perfect the union, the fact that we promise people, right, life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. You know, I love this country. This is my home. I'm an American. I'm just waiting for you to recognize that and give me the papers to show for it.
Jose Antonio Vargas is a Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist and the director of the new film, Documented. And that's it for this hour. To the best of our knowledge comes to you from Madison, Wisconsin, and the studios of Wisconsin Public Radio. Sarah Nix and Raymond Tungekar produced today's show with help from Doug Gordon, Charles Monroe Kane, and Stephanie Youngblood. Our theme music comes from Steve Mullen from Walk West Music. Kirill Owen is our technical director. Steve Paulson is our executive producer. And I'm Ann Strainchamps. Thanks for listening.
PRI, Public Radio International.